it's never too late to start thinking about how you're going to plan for the future. And I think that in America today, we have a consumerism culture, an instant gratification culture, and people who have waited a long time, longer than previous generations, to really be thinking about the future. You have the YOLO mentality, you only live once, and people not looking any further than the moments ahead of them immediately. But today we're going to reverse the trend. David Murata joins us. He is the president of Murata Wealth Management, online at muratahonmoney.com. We're going to be talking about financial planning in your 40s and early 50s, which would affect a whole lot of people. David, welcome to the Shilling Show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
All right, so there's a bunch of steps here that I want to get into today, but the first one I think is very, very important on the list, and it has to do with determining your standard of living. And many people may have never given any thought to this whatsoever. They just live. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's interesting. Even the clients who come into us who are very knowledgeable about their finances don't actually know how much they spend on just taking care of themselves. And and all of wealth management is based on the small changes that have huge effects over time. And it seems to me the first principle of citizenship is every citizen should take care of themselves so as not to burden others. And you need to know what it is that you actually spend to take care of yourself. So we have a number of different ways that you can estimate your standard of living. You can do it by a complete review of your checkbook once a year. You can do it by keeping a budget. You can even do it by reviewing your tax forms, by seeing what came in and where it went, because your tax form has almost all the information you need to be able to do that. But at any rate, even people who have good salaries and, you know, both husband and wife work and they've got income and investments, it's very difficult for them to actually determine, you know, is our standard of living that what we spend on ourselves $50,000? Mm-hmm. Is it $75,000 a year? Is it $100,000 a year? And what you have to take out is you have to take out taxes, which, you know, we're finally past deficit day and tax freedom day. So sometimes their standard of living is smaller than they expect, if we're given the salaries that they make. And you have to take out all of the things that are sort of generating income, but you're not spending it, and get a handle on exactly what you're spending. And what you're spending is one of the determining factors in when you can retire. The smaller your standard of living, the earlier you can retire. It has to do with how your investment should be structured. It has to do with, are you on track for retirement? And so all of those are very, very important. And even a very small change in your standard of living will have huge effects on the financial planning over the next 30, 40 years.
All right. So determining that, very, very important. The next one is a net worth statement. Again, I think, you know, sometimes people have their net worth in places they really can't get their hands on. In other words, they may have a lot of things that they've purchased. Do you count those sorts of things?
Yeah, we divide the net worth into two different components. Things which are useful for retirement, which means that they are liquid, can be spent. They're not planned for a kid's college education or a boat or a vacation or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then all of the other assets. So we generally don't count toward retirement assets the home that you live in, because you need to live somewhere, or the car that you drive, or the things that you own. And if there's one thing working in a wealth management firm that I've seen, is it's the poor buy things. Their houses are cluttered with them. It's amazing how many things the poor have. Middle class buys liabilities. They buy boats and beach houses and things like that. The things that they can afford because they're middle class, but that they don't actually produce any wealth. And the rich buy investments. Mm. So if they buy a piece of property, it's a piece of rental property. And if they buy something, they're putting it into an investments and they're putting it to work. And if that simple mantra is something that will encourage the poor to move to the rich, it's not hard to do. We have clients of very little means, but because they have that rich mentality, they're able to amass $2 million over their lifetime and retire very comfortably because they have such frugal lifestyles.
But we're fighting this consumerism society, and so we look, and I'm not knocking it because I don't have a problem with it, but people need to be able to rein themselves in. And so they think, you know, gosh, if I just get this cell phone and this plan and this cable package and I have these clothes and all of these things that are kind of shiny, if I'm driving this kind of car, even if I have to, you know, go way out on a limb to get it, that's how I'm going to find my happiness. But all of that eventually really declines in value to virtually nothing over time.
Yeah, it's very important to know, I think, what are the triggers for whatever behavior you're trying to change. And so What do you do if you're stressed? What do you do to reward yourself are two incredibly important issues. If when you're stressed or you're trying to reward yourself, you spend money, you will not have money. If you eat, you will be overweight. But if you go for a run or read a book, then you'll be in good health or are highly educated. And mm-hmm. so trying to develop the habits of how to deal with stress in your life, it's usually the stress that triggers these kinds of behaviors that we might want to change. But what I found with our clients is that the peace of mind that comes from knowing you have enough money in the bank to cover all of your wants and needs is priceless. And that kind of peace of mind is what financial planning develops. If financial planning does its job correctly, your life is just unstressed of all of the stresses about finances. And the stresses about finances is what causes people to get divorced. It's what causes people to be suicidal. It's what causes people to be depressed. It's what causes people to be unfulfilled in their careers because they need to go get this job rather than finding the job they were meant for.
So looking at that, I think one thing that people need to be aware of is that it's not worth your life. I mean, you know, we remember the people jumping out of the windows in the Great Depression because they just were so much in despair over this. And I would imagine that if you had anybody that was in that much despair, that you would tell them, look, you know, it's important, but it's not worth doing that.
Right. We've had financial planning clients who, for one reason or another, wanted to pick a career that was going to be a starving artist. And we helped them develop their finances around what a starving artist financial life should look like. And if you live with the means, we used to, when I drove carpool with my kids, we used to drive by a trailer park. And at one point, one of the other kids in the car said, you know, I would never want to live there. And I said, oh, no, if you live there, that's financial freedom because it's very inexpensive. And if you live there, you can decide to be a poet. You can decide to be an artist. You could be a photographer. You know, but if you want to live in a big house, in a big penthouse suite, then there's very few jobs that are going to satisfy that lifestyle. You're going to have to go spend a lot of money, and so you're going to have a lifestyle and a career that supports it.
The terrific thing is, and we're talking with David Marad, is that there are ways to plan for whatever it is you want to do, and really no reason to despair, but really to plan. All right, we get back on the other side. We're going to be talking about getting yourself on track, and then what you ought to be doing regarding your own lifestyle. 977-1070 is the phone number. If you have comments or questions for our guest, David Marotta, we'd love to hear from you. 977-1070. And The Shilling Show with David Marotta returns in just a moment.
I got some troubles, but they won't last.
I always love it when the song comes up because we do broadcast the program from the Democratic Socialist Republic of Charbonneville, now one community, and also affectionately known as Sugartown. David Marotta is our guest, and we continue here on financial planning in your 40s and early 50s. All right, let's talk about the topic of getting on track. Let's say somebody just really hasn't been thinking about this at all, but listening to you today and maybe having some other counsel says, you know what? I probably better get myself on track. Where do we start and what do we do?
Yeah, well, if you've determined your standard of living and you now know how much you have in your net worth that you're saving toward retirement, it's very easy to take your savings and divide by your standard of living and see how many multiples of your standard of living you've saved. Obviously, you need to live from 65 all the way to 90 in retirement, and it turns out that you can count on some growth in that period, so you don't quite need 30 times your standard of living. But you do need about 23, 24. But how do you get there? Because as you get there, it's a geometric progression, so it's an exponential growth. And so by the time you're 40, you only need about 3.8 times your standard of living. So, for example, if you have a $75,000 standard of living, you need about $255,000 to be saved to be on track. But by the time you're 55, you're going to need 12.1. That's almost $1 million. And so that's why the 40s and early 50s is so critical in your savings, because your savings has to be growing during that period. And it's going to more than triple during that period. And you need to have that growth. So every single age, we have a percentage or a multiple of your standard of living that you should have on track. And by 50, you should have about 8.5 times. At 45, you should be up to 5.8. And so you can kind of figure out where you are on the chart, do the math, and figure out if you're ahead or behind on your retirement savings. That's terribly important because even $100 a month over your working career will mean $1 million difference. And so adjusting your savings ever so slightly in your 40s and 50s will make trying to catch up in your late 50s and early 60s not necessary.
You know, this is peripheral in a way to the conversation we're having today, and we've talked about it before, but I wanted to bring this into the conversation because as I look at the cost of goods that I purchase, and particularly going to the grocery store, looking at the cost of food, but really the cost of just about everything and how inflation is destroying the value of the dollar, you know, I think about, well, gosh, if somebody said, well, I have, for example, $100,000 sitting in the bank for retirement. Well, by the time you get to retirement, that might not buy very much. In fact, it's almost certain not to buy very much. And so we've talked before about this, but I want to get your take on, you know, just having money sitting in the bank versus some other method here.
Right. If you have cash in the bank, the amount that you need is tremendously more because you can't just save. You have to save and invest. And if you think of your cash savings this way, just imagine that they're going down by 4.5% every year. It's a tremendous loss of purchasing power. That's also why we don't count your beach house because it's not making money. It's just barely holding its own. That's why we don't count your car because it's depreciating quickly. And you can think of cash in the bank as depreciating as well. And that's why your savings has to be mostly in equity investments because they're going to earn on average about 6.5% over inflation. Bond investments usually make 3% over inflation, but right now bond investments aren't paying very much at all either. And so that's why most people are tilting heavily toward the equity side, just to, if nothing else, just to keep up with inflation and then earn a little bit more on top of that. But yeah, you don't just save, you have to save and invest, and you have to save and invest mostly in equities.
You know, I'm thinking about all of this and how it plays into individual finances. And for example, I mean, if you have a house and the house appreciates, and so now you're getting taxed higher, and you have to pay in dollars that are worth less, and you are getting taxed higher on a house that really may be no more valuable. It's just that the value of the currency has dropped. So this really is a hidden tax and maybe really not even all that hidden.
Yeah, inflation is the one thing that most people don't worry about, but it's almost guaranteed. So it has the highest probability of happening, has the highest probability of affecting your retirement, and yet it's not on most people's radar. Most people worry about the stock market going up and down, but they don't worry about inflation eating away every year at about 4.5% of their purchasing power.
David, let's talk about somebody who wants to reduce their lifestyle, and you recommend saving 15% of your salary. So someone might look at that and say, that's a really tall hill to climb. How am I ever going to do that?
Yeah, 15% is how much you should save, assuming you started saving at age 25. And so every year you delay, that the 15% actually rises. If you've waited all the way until age 40, the correct amount to save is about 43.2%. If you wait all the way until age 50, the correct answer is you need to save 100%. Now, you might think saving 100% is impossible, but what that means is if you have $100,000 in earnings, you have to live off 50 and save the other 50 because you have to. That's how much it's going to take in order to get back on track for retirement. So if you think it's hard now to save 15%, it'll be even harder later because you're going to have a higher value. And most people have a very now-centered mindset, and they don't care if their future selves are aging and living off Social Security and eating cat food so long as they can live it up now. But I think it's the very height of responsibility. And you owe it to your future self to make your future self not miserable. You owe it to your future self in order to have that peace of mind, because that peace of mind is priceless. And you want to be able to have a lifestyle in retirement that one, doesn't burden your children, and the second, doesn't burden society, and third, doesn't burden you with all the miserableness that comes from not having enough money and just living off of Social Security. We talk about Social Security. Social Security is almost 15% of your earnings, and if Social Security were privatized, you wouldn't have to save anything more. But unfortunately, we have Social Security getting a terrible rate of return when you look at what its actual rate of return is. But if you had privatized that and you'd saved and invested your Social Security, we'd all be retiring as millionaires.
But now the government's going in the other direction, saying, hey, we want to start setting up some investment accounts that pay virtually nothing. And so it seems to me that every time this is brought up, people say, yeah, but what if I lost everything? The government at least will protect me from that. And it's always the fear of the downside. Are those legitimate fears?
Yeah, there's a high price to the government protecting you. Government protection is usually the last thing that you want, because the way that government protects your money in Social Security is they take it in and they give it to your parents right out the door. And there's no lockbox. There's nothing left for you. Your Social Security is not saved for you. The only thing that you can get for your Social Security is you can just hope the next generation is willing to fund it with even, you know, half as much as we funded our parents.
But David, that sounds like a Ponzi scheme. If somebody was running that privately, wouldn't they be thrown in jail?
They would certainly be under the SEC review and not keeping assets safe and not fulfilling fiduciary responsibility and a thousand other things. Because it's the government and it's written into law, there's really not a whole lot we can do about it other than petition our government to privatize. There's so many countries now with privatized Social Security, and no politician in any of those countries could ever be elected if they threatened the privatized Social Security, because people are much more protective of that than I think any of us should be with our scheme.
David Morata is our guest. He's online at moratonmoney.com. When we come back on the other side, as we discuss financial planning in your 40s and early 50s, we're going to talk about insurance, what sorts of insurance are valuable, which ones are not, getting your estate plan in order, and then setting up some life planning goals. That takes place on the other side. 977-1070 is the phone number. Comments or questions for David, challenges, he'd love to hear from you. When The Shilling Show returns for our final segment, on the other side, it's 977-1070. Final segment of The Shilling Show for today. Our guest is David Morata. We're talking about financial planning and certain considerations, particularly for your 40s and early 50s, but many of these things are by extension applicable to all age ranges. And Richard is on the line here, and we have a line open for you at 977-1070. Hello, Richard. You're on with David Morata.
Thank you, Rob. Quick question. There's a fellow named Harry Dent who is a Harvard scholar, and he writes profusely, but he's talking about deflation. He's talking about asset values going down, stocks, bonds, housing, gold, silver, everything going down in value, and that the safe haven is the U.S. dollar, and that the inflation trends are overcooked. I was wondering if your guest would speak to that.
Yeah, Richard brings up a great point. I was just reviewing some of that data myself, and I just had a nice lunch with one of the people who teaches at the Federal Reserve retreats. Let me tell you what I think is the most likely. It's not easy to get your head around, but the money supply is dependent upon two things: the amount of money that's in circulation, which the Federal Reserve has increased tremendously with all of their buying of assets and putting out Federal Reserve notes, otherwise known as dollars, into the economy. But the other factor in terms of the money supply is the velocity of money. There's a number of money multipliers: how much the banks are lending, how fast the money's moving around the economy, how much people are either sitting on their money or they're actually putting it into circulation into businesses. It turns out right now, although the Fed is flooding the market with money, the money multipliers are going down, which makes the apparent effect of money actually now going slightly down, which is where we get deflation, because the money multipliers are slowing down. So the theory that I think is the most likely is that we're going to see a period of slight deflation. They're doing everything they can to try to avoid that, followed by a period of hyperinflation as soon as the velocities come back up. And I know that sounds a little bit strange, but I think that's the most likely scenario. Is if we can get the economy going back, we'll see a higher inflation going forward. And
well, two quick comments to that. One is that you have the destruction of money. If you own General Motors stock and General Motors goes bankrupt, then your money disappears entirely and appears over on the federal debt side. And the second point is that it just flew away.
Well, let's take the first point, and then I've got more callers on the line. So, Richard, thank you very much. David, you want to respond to that?
Yes, certainly you can have a tremendous destruction of money if the stock market crashed significantly. Last year, if you use that same logic, last year we had a 30%, more than 30% increase in money as the stock market went up. And I think what you see is you see an inflation and deflation both at work in various parts. Sometimes you see the supply of certain goods going up and going higher, they're the goods that are still in circulation and that are required. And other times you see things actually taking a turn downward. So it's interesting to see how deflation and inflation, probably the best thing that could be said about it is it's incredibly complicated, and it's not always clear that the Fed pushing on a rope is going to work because they can't get much leverage. And although the Fed knows how to curb inflation, you raise interest rates, you put some brakes on the economy, they don't know how to curb deflation, and they're trying everything that they can to try to make sure, even though the velocity of money has gone down, that the movement is still there. But they're not able to do that, partly because of the politics involved. I don't know if you have had the experience, but the lending requirements now are about 8 times worse than they were even a few years ago. And so when you go to actually borrow money, you know, I went to the bank recently twice to borrow money, once to refinance my house, once to finance an office building. And in each case, I had to prove I didn't need a dime before they would loan me money. And it took a process that at the end of the process, I was glad to have the money, but I was not sure it was worth the effort it took to do that in terms of disclosing basically every financial transaction you've done for the past 10 years. It just seemed to be very onerous on the requirements. So unfortunately, although the Fed has flooded banks with money, the banks are not all that anxious to lend, especially if there's going to be a slight deflation. They're lending valuable dollars now, and they're not really going to get that great an interest rate, and they better get really valuable dollars back in the future. And so if there's just slight deflation, they're not sure that's going to be worth it.
Richard, thank you very much. Let's go before we run out of time and say hello to Scott. Hi, Scott. Scott, are you there? All right, I think he's Ellie, I'm going to put him on hold, see if you can get him back. I think he's still there. He just stepped away from the phone for just a second. Let's see if we could do this here. All right, there we go. See if you could pick him back up, Ellie, and see if Scott's there. All right, so we're going to wrap this whole thing up here in our remaining couple of minutes. Let's talk about getting an estate plan in order. How does somebody do that?
It's actually fairly simple. An estate plan, unfortunately, is not a cheap thing. It might cost $3,000 to get done. And depending upon your assets, it can be as simple and less expensive as a will, directives for who's going to take control of your children, where the money goes, medical directives and things like that. It's just something. The minute you have kids, you should make sure you have it. And even if you don't have kids, you should make sure it all flows in the right directions. And then the biggest thing for an estate plan is actually making sure that it's correctly implemented. So when you're done with the estate planning attorney, he will tell you, and here's the things you need to do. And it's just a service to your heirs to be able to have all of your papers in order. And then making sure you have the right insurance. So if you have children especially, I think some term life insurance. If you have significant assets, umbrella insurance, and so that would be the other two things to make sure that you get done if you have children.
I think Scott's back with us. Scott, we got about a minute. Go right ahead with David Murata.
Perfect. I'll make it quick. David, I quite frequently listen to a nationally syndicated talk show host, Clark Kellogg. I think your radio station may cover it or have it, but he seems to subscribe to the theory that someone in their like late 50s should become more of an investor than a saver than an investor. What do you think of that philosophy?
I don't know. I'm not sure why. The Journal of Financial Planning suggests that at age 65, you should have at least 75% in equities and 25% in bonds. It gives you the best chance of having a retirement for the next 30, 35 years. At age 50, you're going to have 50 years, and bonds may not be able to support your lifestyle sufficiently. Now, if you're very, very frugal and you're not spending any money, then you can afford to either be all in bonds or all in stocks. You could be all in bonds because you don't need the growth, and you could be all in stocks because if the market bounces around, it doesn't really matter. This money is actually being invested for your heirs who are younger. But if you're living right on the edge, there is a correct amount, and it's about 5 to 7 years of safe spending in bond investments and putting anything 8 years and longer on the equity side to make sure it's going to keep up with inflation. I have seen some strategies which get very crazy, but I don't recommend them for the average person, which is to put everything in inflation-protected securities or zero-coupon bonds, and then put the rest into wild stock market bets. But you're trying to build something that's as stable as possible. And generally, what we try to do is diversify stocks across the entire world and across all of the different sectors of the economy.
All right, callers, thank you so much. David Murata, always a great hour with you. Thanks for joining us. You can visit him online at muratahonmoney.com. Thanks, David.
Thank you very much.
All right, that's going to wrap the Shilling Show for today, but we'll be back tomorrow to do it all over again. Adam Credo joins us on the Iran drone threat. Did you hear they reverse-engineered our drone? That's pretty scary stuff. We'll get to all that tomorrow. We'll see you soon on the Shilling Show and online at shillingshow.com.